Well, thank you for tuning into the Bird Nerd Book Club. I'm your host, Hannah, and I am excited to welcome Gretchen N. Newberry, author of The Night Hawk's Evening, Notes of a Field Biologist, that was published in 2021 by Oregon University Press. Well, welcome, Gretchen. Would you please tell us about yourself?
Well, yeah. So I'm a biologist. I am from the Midwest, but I live in Portland now. So when I did my research, I went back to the Midwest to study this really understudied species, the common nighthawk. And they are a member of the most threatened bird guild in the world, the aerial insectivores, which includes swifts, swallows, and also bats. And I tried to do it in the most threatened habitat in the world, which is grasslands. So people often ask me, why did you study this, very obscure bird? And that's my answer, I guess.
Well, it was very fun to read throughout your book, you saying that, because I didn't really even know that it was one of the, most understudied birds, families at least. But how, when folks ask you about your book, because it's been out for a couple of years, how do you describe it?
So I tried to write about my experiences and talk about things like environmental physiology and climate change in a way that's accessible through storytelling. So I felt like my story was pretty unusual. I thought I studied a pretty unusual bird, but I had all these sort of interesting bits of science that I thought were really important for people to know, like how animals adapt to the environment. Through their biology has a lot to do with how they survive climate change. And I thought this bird was a great example to explain all that. And for people who are really interested in that topic, I thought, oh, I can tell this bird story.
So you started off with swallows, though, and you moved to nightjars. How was the transition from day to night?
It was really interesting. Because nighthawks are crepuscular, it was mostly, work around sunset initially when I was doing surveys. But then when I went to look for their nests, I had to find them during the day when they're actually on their nests. So for a while, I was sort of, in the beginning, I was living really at night and people didn't see me all summer, right? They were like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just becoming a nighthawk. Don't ask too many questions. It's pretty weird. And then once I found the nests, I was working kind of two shifts every day, finding the nests and then finding the nighthawks. And fortunately, at the very end, I could just focus on the day because that was getting really exhausting.
Yeah, I imagine. So speaking of the nesting habits of nightjars, you say in your book, have I mentioned that this is a bird that tries almost desperately to survive? So what do you mean by that?
Well, they're so adaptable. They are generalists. So the common nighthawk can live in so many habitats. This is a bird that lives from Alaska to Argentina, coast to coast. And it can live in grasslands or rooftops or sandbars, beaches, open forests, deserts. There's so many habitats that they can live in. But even generalists are struggling in this world where we keep stripping away their habitats until they become specialists. And I think we as biologists and conservationists, we often take generalists for granted until they're no longer really common. I always think about Rosalie Barrow Edge. She said the time to conserve a species is when it's common. Once things get, close to being listed, it's really difficult to bring them back to what they were.
You mentioned, coast to coast and all different kinds of habitats and everything. So what is it about nightjars that make them so adaptable?
They are ground nesters, and all they really need in order to find their, find a nest site is to find something they can camouflage with. So often it's like gravel or, pine needles or leaf litter, anything. And so they have this really mottled appearance. They have, so many different beiges and browns that they can really match with. And the other thing is all they need to do is eat insects, and insects are found everywhere. it's just not found every day. So if there's like a cold day, you don't see insects much. So is they're really short breeding season, but they can do a lot during that period, and that's what makes them so adaptable.
Yeah, and it was really fun reading in your book about all the different places that you found nests and all the, rooftops that you were searching and everything, and how incredibly hot these birds are existing in and being able to, some of them, their eggs made it and some of them didn't. It just really shows that there's a lot of struggles that they face.
And one other aspect of their adaptability is their ability to live in extreme heat. They have this ability to go into torpor, which is a short version of hibernation, in which they lower their body temperature or lower their metabolism. They do all these things to adapt to whatever situation, physiologically, so that they don't burn a lot of calories. I've handled birds that were pretty stressed and kind of entered a kind of a semi-awake state, and it was hard to wake them up and get them to fly away again. This is kind of common for nighthawks. I dealt with that with swallows too. They kind of, if they get really stressed out, they sort of check out, and then you kind of have to wait for them to wake up for them to fly away. So they're pretty vulnerable that way. And if you have a bunch of period days in a row where it's too cold or too hot, and they're entering that state, that's pretty dangerous for them because they're not eating during that time.
So you really show in your book about how little information there was about these species. And you went to conferences and there wasn't a whole lot of conversation about like nighthawks in general. So what is it about nighthawks that make them understudied?
Well, in general, they're part of this family, the nightjars. In general, there aren't a lot of people studying them. And the reason is because most of them are nocturnal, those birds. Nighthawks are different in that they are crepuscular, so they're a little easier to study. So because they're nocturnal, not a lot of people want to work at night or try to find them. They're pretty difficult. One thing they all have on their side is they call a lot. They make a lot of noise at night, and so you can kind of triangulate where they are and then try to search for them during the day on their nests. It's tricky. And so one thing that nightjar researchers do is they band together. So there's this thing called the Global Nightjar Network, and we have an annual meeting. And this is a super cool conference because it's people all over the world, people in Singapore, people in South Africa, people in North America, people in South America, Israel. There's all England. Nightjars are on every continent except Antarctica. And so we all sort of band together, and there's always these common themes like, how'd you find them? How did these survive all these extreme temperatures? These are kind of common themes in this research.
Okay, well, that's really cool that you all have a support system to work together and try to solve these problems across the world.
Yeah, it's super cool. And there's an element of outreach that's really important because people don't know about these birds at all. One part of researching them is contacting a landowner and then educating them about the birds that might be on them because they've never heard of them.
Yeah, that's a great point. So what sort of what are some of your like elevator pitches to tell farmers why, we need to protect and preserve these species?
Well, the main thing is they eat insects, so everybody is concerned about insects on their land. So whether they have livestock that they don't, want to be, they don't want mosquitoes or all kinds of parasites that might affect their livestock, or whether they have crops that could be impacted by pest species. Having an animal that eats its weight in insects every day is super important. So attracting swallows, swifts, nighthawks, and bats to land is great to have around. And where I studied them in urban environments, super important because people don't want to be bitten by insects. So,
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't like mosquitoes, so I'll be happy to have nightjars around.
yeah.
So part of what you discuss in your book is your experience as a graduate student. And I think that is just super valuable to read is, you know, you have the challenges of getting grants, especially for maybe a project, well, a project that you came up with. So it wasn't necessarily something a professor had, you know, designated, I want a grad student for this, and here's the funding for it. Was that part of your goal to share the challenges of being a grad student?
In the book, yeah, for sure. And I thought it was important to tell people, like, hey, if you find the right advisor and you have ideas, then they'll be open to it. And I was really lucky with my advisor, Dave Swanson, at University of South Dakota. He had some experience with, first of all, he's well known for environmental physiology, and he's worked with night jars before. So he wasn't intimidated by the idea that I wanted to study a nighthawk. And I can't tell you how many people had come up to me in conferences and said, gosh, I wish I could have studied nighthawks, but my advisor talked me out of it. So Dave was not as scared of that. He had contacts with people who, like Mark Brigham in Saskatchewan, who runs this lab of nightjar studiers, you know. So, and he studies bats as well. And there was all these environmental physiologists that Dave worked with. So this was a network of people that helped each other out. It was definitely not just me alone, for sure. But I, after studying swallows, I had all these questions about aerial insectivores, and so I wanted to study the least studied of aerial insectivores, and that was the nighthawk for sure.
So on page 100, you mentioned my purpose was to find out what nighthawks were doing in declining grasslands. So what did you find out?
Adapting, well, trying to at least. They moved onto rooftops because they lost a lot of their grassland habitat in the ethanol boom, which happened late 90s, early 2000s. We lost the equivalent of the size of Kansas in this country, in terms of grassland. That's a lot of grassland that got converted to corn. So these nighthawks, I mean, even though they were already on rooftops, that was a process that started when people started building buildings in the late 1800s. I mean, as early as I don't know what year, but Boston is like the first recorded city where there were nighthawks on a rooftop in the 1800s. But that exacerbated during the agricultural revolution and then the ethanol boom. So they moved onto rooftops, and even though they have the skills to cope, and you know, the physiology to cope with urban heat island effect, these newer roofing types are edging out these gravel roofs that they need for their camouflage. So there's this plastic coated white canvas that people are converting to that's more energy efficient, and that's great news, but that means that for nighthawks and other birds that are nesting on these rooftops, it's a challenge for them, especially if they have nowhere else to go. And it's not just nighthawks, it's killdeer as well. So these rooftops are also getting really too hot. So only 10% of my nests fledged a chick, and that's mostly because the chicks didn't hatch or they drowned in thunderstorms on these rooftops that are becoming more and more frequent. So really, climate change was a major factor in their survival. I mean, they can run around and escape puddles and find shade after a few days, but those first few days and when they're an egg are especially vulnerable.
Wow, yeah, that's crazy. 10%, that's terrible. So, I don't own a grassland, and I imagine many of my listeners don't own grasslands either. So, what are some things that I can do to help Nighthawks?
Well, there's this thing called duck stamps. So the National Wildlife Refuge System runs a program called duck stamps, and they are traditionally sold to hunters so they can hunt on national wildlife refuges. But that money goes back into a lot of that goes back into the central migratory pathway in the center of the country, where a lot of migrating birds, grassland birds, and wetland birds really, really, really depend on them. And so that money goes into easements and the growth of refuges, and in some cases that money trickles down into state conservation programs as well. And that middle of the country, often these states have really small conservation budgets. So it's especially important. There was a bust period after the ethanol boom in which Farmers were trying to get rid of their row crop land. Like they weren't making enough money off ethanol, so that their land was really like losing money. And so they wanted to find a way to offload it or at least get some sort of tax credit for it. And so a lot of this went into easements that were then managed by the refuge system. And I did a lot of surveys and found a lot of migrating and wetland birds and grassland birds that really depended on those easements. So we as birders, we don't think to buy duck stamps because we don't tend to hunt as much. So there is no analogous thing that we purchase to a duck stamp. But if we go out and go to our national wildlife refuge and buy a duck stamp, that goes back to support all of that center of the country land that's so important. And it also supports wildlife artists that through an annual contest where they make this duck stamp.
Yeah, it's very cool. I was getting them for a while, and I always wish they would come out with some, like, I don't know, songbird stamp or something like that, for birders to say, like, I'm doing this specifically as a birder too.
That's a brilliant idea. I love that idea. They also have a junior duck stamp too. So like high school kids and middle school kids, I think, can do that. And so, and that can be less traditional wildlife art, not just the duck art, which is also nice, but the junior stamps are kind of creative and cool too.
Yeah, that's great to know some of the different ways that the funding is being used too. So thank you for sharing on that. So what is it that you hope that folks learn from reading your book?
Well, I like to, for people to think about the species and the places that are kind of beyond our day-to-day experience for most people, the camouflaged animals, and the Great Plains I mentioned before, the so-called flyover country. A lot of people who love conservation live in those states, but they're obviously the interest is way more concentrated on the coast based on people's political preferences. And so we can't really give up on the middle of the country because it's so important to conservation. But yeah, so think about all the life that is around us all the time, even wherever we live, right? There's a lot of species that are just we're not really aware of because they're so cryptic. And so the things that we do really affect them. So I always think of this analogy, like a lot of people really like think about alien life on another planet, but there's so much alien life that just surrounds us that I would love for people to appreciate and understand more and more.
Yeah, and I think anytime you do see a nighthawk, it's kind of special. So just branching that out to maybe some of the other species too, that you might not cherish as much as, your bluebirds or whatever.
Right, yeah, for sure.
So what's next on the horizon for you?
Well, I graduated in 2018, and ever since then I've done some outreach, but also I'm a day-to-day biologist. But I'm also a volunteer for surveys like the Swift Watch here in Portland, which is super cool. And I'm a birder, and so through all that, I'm just sort of building new experiences to hopefully write another book about with stories again someday. So, I like books that are about storytelling, like firsthand experience. And so, I would like to write another book someday, but first, I gotta live a little to do it.
Well, I know I've definitely enjoyed reading your book, so thank you so much for putting that out there. I learned a ton about Nighthawks and about South Dakota, and about the journey of what it is to be a grad student working on these sorts of things. So thank you so much, and I know it's been a couple of years, but congratulations. It's still exciting to have written a book.
Yeah, thank you so much. And we're both alumni of Oregon State University, so I think that's super cool that you read that and could relate to it. It was yeah, I love that people can relate to it.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, thank you so much for tuning into the Bird Nerd Book Club, and I appreciate you listening. So, if you would like to check me out on the socials, you can follow me at Hannah Goes Birding on Instagram. My Twitter is at Women Birders HH, or you can email me at Hannah and Eric Go Birding at gmail.com.